these big, what looks like adventures. Maybe you can tell us what is going on here. Because, you know, Russia and China, obviously these are big powers.
I think you probably know the answer to the question, which is that there's a faction in the Republican and Democratic Party and in the U.S. media as a whole, which wants the United States to be the world hegemon. And in the West, there's a very deep, deep global financial crisis. Hyperinflation is out of control. The debt structure in the entire West is a disaster. And what they're proposing as a solution is continued massive hyperinflation to keep the bubble going, and the Green New Deal to get the world, including Iran, to get out of fossil fuels and out of nuclear. China is not accepting this. Russia is not accepting this. So China and Russia are both targets of this war faction in the West, which is proceeding out of desperation. At the same time, I would make the point that a new strategic element in the world as a whole is this unique collaboration now between China and Russia. They are inseparable from the standpoint of economic policy, development policy, strategic policy, and therefore, in the West, those who would push the West towards war may be facing war against Russia and China simultaneously, and this hopefully will function as a wise deterrent.
Okay, Don DeBar, my last question to you, quickly if you can. The Chinese ambassador to the U.S. issued a warning, possible military conflict over Taiwan. So my question, what are the chances of the U.S. being involved in a military confrontation with China compared to one with Russia?
He wants to be the Greek, not me. That faction that Richard speaks of, by the way, exists. The faction is called Congress, the White House, Langley, the Pentagon, the Supreme Court, every other institution of power that the United States has, and the media. That is the war faction in this thing, the one that wants hegemony. There does not seem to be a constituency outside of the political forces organized around Trump and maybe somewhat around Sanders that are even willing to consider the possibility of a multipolar world rather than this hegemonic one that they've been striving for, certainly since 1991. But 1991 is really a product of their striving before that.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Don DeBar, journalist and political activist there, and a radio host from
ASEAN.
Richard Black, I'm sorry we're fresh out of time. Representative to the UN from the Schiller Institute, who spoke to us from Hackensack, New Jersey. We'll bring you on for another program, I'm sure. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitavoy, the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Habib and Sayyid Mohsen. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
An old question, and so many new answers are given to that, especially in today's world, with these so-called broad-minded intellectuals within the religion of Islam and out of that, Quran, is it the word of Allah or Muhammad? Okay, let's start with Sayyid Mohsen.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, definitely this is the word of Allah. It is not the word of any man. And okay. Within the Quran, we have the verses that prove this.
Okay.
And even...
What's the verse?
About the words of Allah, obviously, he said about the prophet that وَمَا يَنْتَقُ عَنِ الْهَوَىٰ إِنْ هُوَ إِلَّا وَحْيٌ يُوحَىٰ. That's the first thing. The second thing is obviously Quran is from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and obviously if it was from anyone else or the things that you see, if there were two of them, you would see corruption in it. Obviously two people cannot manage one thing. So there are many other verses as well, like in regards to this. And obviously when we say this is the word of Allah, we need to prove why it is the word of Allah, not word of a man or a person. Number one, the first thing is that the Prophet himself has said that this is not from me, this is from Allah. Obviously he had some narrations, we have some traditions from the Prophet, and there's some of the parts of his speeches are the parts of the Quran. And he himself at that time has mentioned that these are the wordings of Allah, this is the part of the Quran. And the things which he has said as a tradition, he did not give any explanation about it. So this is the first thing when we look at the history to know about it.
Yes.
But there are other proofs. Obviously, there are many questions that how you prove, what is the role of miracle here? Can we believe in these things and all those things? So
Archangel
this
Gabriel.
Obviously, these are the lengthy, we can say.
You know,
can I give a quick answer to that?
Okay.
It's a very simple answer, actually. During the time of the Prophet, who was he brought to who the Quran was brought forward?
Mm-hmm.
It was brought to Arabs.
Okay.
Which Arabs? The Arabs that were known for their poetry and their eloquence and their high sophisticated Arabic language.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran is challenging the Arabs to bring verses like the Holy Quran,
yes,
why would they go into war to fight Islam? Bring up verses that will fight the verses of the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
And rebuke the and therefore criticize the Prophet. Therefore, the Prophet would sit down and say that, yeah, they brought the verses. I can't bring it. They won. But they didn't do that. No, they had to lose their lives in war. So at the end of the day, that brings up the fact that they were unable to. Them being unable to and going into war, still fighting Islam, this is pretty much the point of the miracle of the Quran.
I think the new generation of the scholars who studied the Quran are not concerned with the... with it being a revelation or not, but no, I mean the Muslims, the believing ones, they believe that it was a revelation, but they are mostly talking about this mechanism of the revelation, how it was revealed to Prophet Muhammad. Okay, this is the howness of the revelation. Okay?
Nice, very nice.
Not
yes,
the whatness
yes.
of the revelation.
Yeah, there's this thing that I wanted to say just before I give the answer to your question, that it's believed that why are scholars, Islamic scholars, considered holy? It's because they learn the sayings of the companions. This is a Sunni saying. They learn the sayings of the companions, and the companions learn the sayings of the Prophet, and the Prophet takes his knowledge from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is holy, therefore our knowledge is holy. We have this knowledge, so therefore we're considered holy.
Okay.
That's one thing. It's it's something that, you know, we have this, it's in the back of our minds. Yes. It's something that it's what we call in mutasalam alay, something accepted, and
yes.
therefore we don't study it.
Something absolute and accepted. Okay.
Sheikh Mahdi Ma'rifat, great Quranic science teacher.
At-Tamheed.
Yeah, At-Tamheed, eight volumes. There's also Mukhtasar At-Tamheed, and then Mukhtasar At-Tamheed.
Okay.
Yeah, and very beautifully put this topic forward, and how the howness of the revelation. How does a human body with a human innate connect to something unhuman and gain the knowledge from the unseen? And it's put forward that the spirit and the, you know, the cleanness of the spirit and the mental capacity of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi and whatnot and whatnot. But at the end of the day, I want to ask this question. Does it change anything?
It does.
How?
In a way, of course.
This is a serious question. I'm not questioning for argument's sake.
No, this is not my opinion. At least it will cut out some of the... some of the so-called, this is not my opinion, but in their opinions, imaginary stories about a Gabriel or an angel coming down, giving the verses to the Prophet Muhammad, or the other, for example, hallucinatory dreams or illusions that were around Prophet Muhammad, okay? At least it will give a realistic, it's better to say, interpretation out of the mechanism of wahy, isn't it?
Yeah, the thing is that it's either one of two. Either the devils, right?
Okay.
It's either the devils or his craze, or it's the angels.
Okay.
When you look at the meanings put in the words of the Holy Quran, Do these meanings come from the devil?
That's my question. Of course not.
Thank you very much. Okay. Does these highly sophisticated words and meanings come from a person in craze?
But according to this Egyptian scholar, Nas Hamed Abu Zayd, who says that there is still a relation between this meaning of the wahy with what was before the religion of Islam, as wahy, a kind of connection with the worlds of the jinns, okay? The meaning of the wahy, okay, over there. And when Prophet Muhammad said that this Quran is a wahy to me, the Arabs on that time understood it was as if the wahy was defined in terms of...
How did the Arabs understand that when they would call him crazy and they would say that it was a shaitan, it was the devil that's giving him the word?
No, this is not the
that's
devil.
That's contradictory to
no,
the verse.
No, this is not devil, but the word of the jinns, a world unknown or secretive to the Arabs, isn't it?
Well, the Arabs at that time didn't understand this meaning, which he's saying after 1,000...
They understood.
No, they understood.
How did they understand the meaning when the verses
are
saying that?
I mean the meaning which he has brought after 1,400 years after the revelation.
Exactly, yeah.
The Arabs at that time didn't understand this meaning, which he can understand
now.
Do
you know why? Because
so obviously we need to refer to the history to this part, and this is not acceptable.
So there are so many examples of the poets and the poetic devices over there. I mean, the Arabs who used to be famous through their poetries, okay? And when they ask them, where do these, for example, the verses of your poets come from, it is because of our relation to the worlds of the jinns, and not, for example, a supernatural being or the power of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, okay?
I personally haven't read the words of this Egyptian scholar, but I will,
them. He is among those scholars, Nas Hamed Abu Zayd, you know.
I'll read it, no problem. Okay. I'll return to it. But for now, what I have in my mind right now is that we have to understand the meaning of the miracle of the Quran. There are a couple of theories out there of what is the meaning of the Quran being a miracle. There's the theory of Sayyid al-Murtada, as-Sarf, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala took away the free will from people to have the chance to bring in, you know, new verses that are in front of the Quran.
That's right.
There's also the theory of the scientific facts and the pure judgments that the Quran has, which is also accepted nowadays, and it's highly accepted as well. And the main one, which is the eloquence of the Holy Quran. And I think when you have to go back and understand the meaning of the eloquence of the Quran, what is the meaning of eloquence? Is it bringing beautiful words without the correct meaning?
Mm-hmm.
No, it's the way that you bring the words for the people that you're talking to in a precise way, in a precise meaning, with high meanings.
Yes.
البلاغة مطابقة الكلام لمقتضى الحال.
Yes.
I don't know the correct Arabic translation for it, but that's the meaning of balagha, or eloquence, which is pretty much, you know, trying to explain it, is that you bring in these words, words that have the correct meaning suitable for the people that you're talking to the highest mentality possible for the suitable audience.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the best way to put it out there.
Okay.
And at the end of the day, this person is stating that this wahi, the reality of the Prophet gaining, is something that the devil's brought forward. If the devil's brought forward, the devils of those are also able to bring it forward as well. So why is the contradiction?
We got different interpretations, you know. It's very unfortunate to say that most of them are Iranians nowadays, you know, in the world. Like Suroosh, like Mujtahid Shabastari, and the other guys, you know, Muhammad Argun, okay, also Nas Hamed Abu Zayd, and the other guys, you know, who try to give, a fact-based, realistic interpretation or picture out of the system of the revelation. One of them call it in a dreamlike form or imagination.
I have a question for them.
Okay.
How are you reaching to this point? What are your bases of knowledge in this? That's my question. How did you know that this is the way? Are you doing qiyas? Are you pretty much, you know, looking at similar things? You're analogizing things. Analogy does not bring certainty.
Yes.
It does not bring knowledge.
Okay.
It brings you assumption, and your assumptions are not correct. Are not always correct. They could be wrong.
That's right. Okay, Sayyid.
Well, the point is, these people who are talking about these things, how they're experiencing. Have they experienced this by themselves that they're explaining, or as brother has said, like on which basis are they talking? The problem for the people today is they try to understand things through sciences, and science says that if you can sense these things through your senses, and anything which can be obviously known by the senses or the experiments, that is something acceptable for them.
Yes.
Whereas we have something which is is beyond all these things. And even about the wahi, we have different meanings in the Quran. For example, the wahi on the mother of Musa.
Yes.
It was an inspiration.
Yes.
The wahi, which is on the
something
prophet,
that brought into her heart. Okay. She followed it.
Yes. So, and the wahi, in the sense of Quran, has its own meanings. Now, the beauty of the Quran is that when we talk about the Quran, Quran is not just the book of Allah, but obviously it is a miracle. And on top of that, when it is a miracle, it has a tahaddi. Tahaddi means it's challenging people that you should bring it. Now, it's 1,400 years from the time Quran was revealed. No one could bring even a single verse.
Oh, they got that answer to this question. It is like the other works that were produced by the other peoples around the world who has not the like.
Why?
For example, the words of the poetry or an author or a writer or, I don't know, for example, William Shakespeare.
We have a better work. There are people who have brought better things than what they have. And Quran is challenging to bring even one verse.
I know, brother, but this
one verse means, you know, when you look at the Shakespeare work, you look at the whole work as all.
Okay.
You don't look at just one point or one phrase or one verse of the point. Whereas Quran says just bring even a single verse. You know, this much of challenge that has been brought in the Quran, you cannot see. Whereas you can see the similar works done by other things which are done by the other humans, even a small part of it.
I think that there's a problem with them understanding the meaning of eloquence. When you study balagha, you understand. Well, now I can't say the terms on the radio, right? For example, the saja, or for example, the qafiyah, which is pretty much the last words.
Yes.
Or for example, the using the words of huruf al-halaq at the precise time, using the letters that come out of, for example, the throat.
Wasn't it the way that the Arabs used to talk on that time? I mean, the normal speaking
way? That's the thing. Like how Jesus Christ. People at that time, medicine was booming at that time, right?
Yes.
Medicine was booming at that time. Jesus Christ came and made miracles of medicine. He brought people back to life. He made the blind see back with eyesight again, right? He had this miracle. He had this power. It was the same thing. People were doing medical things. He was doing his medical thing as well. This medical thing was God-given. That medical thing was human. Was a humankind thing. So at the end of the day, Arabs were talking Arabic. Okay. They had this power.
Yes.
That is why they used to, you know, the person that was a poet that time was not only respected. You know how we respect people with knowledge nowadays? You know how we respect the people with high prestige?
Yes.
People with poetry power or who were poets were considered highly respected people. And they were people that were loved and cherished.
Yes.
And they were so much. They would come and, you know, they would battle with these poems and they would sit down and just talk about poems. It was all their talk.
Okay.
Their eloquence was all their talk. When these verses came, they're not going to come to Habib, who was an American, who barely could speak Arabic and English. And, you know, well, I don't know why RRB is bringing him to the radio show. But anyway, but it's not going to challenge me. It's going to challenge the true Arabs, the people that truly know the meaning of the poems, truly know how to put poems forward. And that is why there are a lot of stories. Whenever the challenges would come, even bring one verse that's like the Quran. Okay. People they would say that we can't. They would say that we can't. Enemies. We're not talking about friends. We're talking about enemies. Enemies, people who are going to fight the Prophet, who are fighting the Prophet, they say we can't bring it forward. Isn't that enough for you to just accept that the fact that it's highly eloquent, the Arabs at the time accepted it?
Thank you very much, Brother Habib.
You're welcome.
And Sayyid Mohsen for a presence in the program. Viewpoints talking about the Holy Quran as the words of Allah or Prophet Muhammad. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information on this episode and our other episodes of the program Viewpoints, visit our website at parstudio.com/en, Call of Islam page, also our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi Aman Allah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness, everything which makes no sense, know that you exist. You guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong. What that often lies, as I don't need anyone, anything in life but you.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Syria's northeastern city of Hasaka is located in a resource-rich part of Syria. The city is not fully controlled by the Syrian government. U.S. troops and their allied Kurdish militants are in control in many key areas here. Hasaka has been the scene of fierce clashes between Daesh terrorists and members of the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces over the past week. Chaotic scenes first erupted on January 20th, when a large group of Daesh terrorists launched a surprise assault on the Gueran prison in Hasaka. They were trying to help thousands of their comrades to escape from the prison. Daesh terrorists used explosive-laden cars to force their way into the prison, triggering a major jailbreak. They also seized weapons and took over several cell blocks. Following days of battles and many American airstrikes, Kurdish militants said they managed to fully recapture the detention facility after the assailants inside the prison gave up. The brazen assault was the latest reminder of increasing Daesh activities in Syria. When this latest episode in Hasaka was over, the Syrian government reacted to the development. Damascus says what happened in Hasaka this week was in line with American efforts to justify its military presence in different parts of Syria.
The U.S. props up or has some sort of involvement with these terrorist groups, such as the case with Daesh, and then in the same hand wants to say, we're going to move in or remain in this country to snuff out this terrorism threat, when I mean, that's not really what it's about. The United States just wants to have the appearance of being concerned about stopping terrorism. But in reality, it seems like the U.S. is the one who's the most prominent in propping them up.
Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations stressed that the recent events in Hasaka require the U.N. Security Council to act. Sabah called on the Council to work toward putting an end to the presence of U.S. forces in northeastern Syria and the southern Al-Tanf region. He also demanded the U.S. halt its support for the Kurdish-led SDF and terrorist groups and its plunder of Syria's natural resources and assets. Sabah echoed comments by Syria's president's political and media advisor, Butina Shaban. She said in December that the U.S., under the guise of its anti-terrorism mission, intervened in Syria, occupied parts of the country, and plundered its resources like oil and natural gas. When Daesh began seizing large parts of Iraq and Syria in 2014, the U.S. was widely accused of involvement in the creation of the terrorist group. Some, even inside the United States, like former President Donald Trump, said that the group was created by the United States. Before coming into office, U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to end America's quote-unquote forever wars. But there are no signs that America intends to pull out the hundreds of its forces in northern Syria who were deployed there without any mandate from the UN or permission from Damascus.
No, Trump was not really that concerned with bringing peace to the Middle East, and Biden is not that concerned with bringing peace either. It's both of them saw the Middle East as a great geopolitical area to destabilize, to ensure that Russia and China have to clean up the mess or help clean up the mess that the United States created.
U.S. officials with knowledge of the Biden administration's plans say that the U.S. will not be pulling out of northeastern Syria anytime soon.
Mali's government has called on Denmark to immediately withdraw troops deployed to the West African nation. Malian officials say the reason to ask Copenhagen for the troops' withdrawal is because officials in Bamako were not consulted and the deployment failed to follow protocol. Mali says all troops' deployments in the country need a prior accord with the government before deployments in the African nation. The decision comes amid tension between Mali and regional bodies and the European Union that have sanctioned Mali after the transitional government failed to organize elections following two military coups.
Danish forces, without identifying themselves to Malian authorities, committed a huge breach in regard to their internal security and also diplomatic relations between the two countries.
About 90 personnel, including sergeants and special forces, and logistics support, were deployed in Mali. Their mandate was supposed to last until early 2023. They were part of Takuba Task Force, which is made up of European special forces. It's based on an initiative by France. Takuba's 900 soldiers are to help Mali's army acquire the combat skills necessary to become self-reliant.
It's a very outrageous situation. I think they are victims of European imperialist intervention. France, which is a former colonial power, intervened 9 years ago, yet the security situation inside the country is far worse than it was in 2013.
A French mission began in Mali in 2013 with the purported aim of countering militants linked to Al-Qaeda and Daesh terrorist groups. France is a former colonizer of Africa. It has deployed thousands of soldiers to presumably prevent separatist forces from reaching Mali's capital, Bamako. In December, Paris withdrew from northern Mali and the city of Timbuktu, 9 years after launching a war without the initial approval of the United Nations or the French Parliament.
So I do believe that France, you know, has committed grave errors in regard to its intervention in Mali. And
the war caused several thousand deaths and more than a million people to flee their homes. The withdrawal came amid growing demonstrations against France's military presence in Mali, which has been wracked by two military coups in little over a year.
I think France, you know, because of its colonial history in West Africa, is not able to extricate itself voluntarily. What we've noticed over the last several months, there's been numerous demonstrations against French military presence in Mali and in other West African countries, including Burkina Faso. At the same time, we have a new rash of military interventions and seizures of power in all of these Sahel countries.
France has been one of the world's colonizing countries that, after many years of slavery, still controls countries spread over more than 12 territories and treats their people as second-class citizens. It has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa since 1960, when many of its former colonies gained independence.
Brutality prevails, and that is the imperialist hegemony seeking to extend its influence and maintain its influence internationally.
Mali remains among the poorest countries in the world, but that's not due to a lack of resources. France currently has 5,100 troops in the arid and volatile Sahel region. Under a new plan, they will be reduced to up to 3,000 troops. Analysts say it's premature to call it the end of France's military intervention in Africa, believing Paris is only readjusting its post-colonial plans.
The Yemeni army has launched a massive retaliatory operation against Saudi Arabia and the UAE, the two allies waging war on the country since 2015. It says vital and sensitive targets were accurately struck with drones and missiles.
They targeted the Safra airport. They also hit the Abu Dhabi airport with a big number of ballistic missiles, Zulfiqar. They targeted facilities in the area of Dubai with a big number of drones and unmanned planes of Samad 3. Also, several military posts in the heart of the Saudi area, in the area of Shobra, and other Saudi towns with bigger numbers of Samad 1 unmanned planes and also artillery fire. They hit very sensitive areas in Jazan and Asir, also with a big number of ballistic missiles.
Sari said the Yemeni army would continue its retaliatory attacks and respond to escalation with escalation. Saudi Arabia and the UAE have both confirmed the retaliatory strikes, but said they intercepted the ballistic missiles. The attack comes just a week after Yemeni forces struck several targets inside the Emirati soil using drones and ballistic missiles.
This war, this conflict has been doomed from the start, from the Saudi and UAE perspective, from the perspective of the coalition, from the perspective of the invaders. There is no chance for them to win. That's why there are several countries that are officially part of this coalition or allies of this coalition who have in reality barely contributed to it because they know there is no point to it.
The strikes are part of the reprisal attacks over the Saudi-led coalition's war in Yemen, which has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and plunged the country into the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Following Yemen's latest attack on the UAE, the U.S. Embassy and its consular mission in the Emirates advised Americans there to, quote, maintain a high level of security awareness. The statement urges U.S. citizens to take appropriate steps to bolster their personal security. The American Embassy issued a similar alert last week when the UAE was targeted by Yemeni missiles and drones. The Yemeni army is now warning international firms and investors to leave the UAE as the country is insecure and will be targeted as long as it continues its aggression against Yemen. The sheikhdom is now feeling the economic consequences of the attacks. On Monday, the Dubai stock index fell by 2%, while Abu Dhabi stocks closed lower.
This has been very damaging for the economy of the UAE, which is based completely on trade, on commerce, on being a transit hub for both material and non-material trading and products that go around here. That's the only real thing that the country floats on. Without this commercial backing, the country has no future, and they think they know that very well.
Last week, the impoverished nation was hit by another round of brutal strikes by the Saudi war machine that targeted a prison, claiming dozens of more innocent lives. The Yemenis have shown that the continuous onslaught on their nation won't weaken their resolve to defend their country.
Germany's stance in the escalating tensions between Russia and Ukraine is under increased scrutiny. Although other NATO allies, including the US, have also agreed to export weapons directly to Ukraine, the German government has so far declined to do so. The Wall Street Journal reported on Saturday that Berlin has refused to issue permits for weapons exports from Estonia to Ukraine.
The Germans do have a history of de-escalating and of not trying in any case to be in the forefront if there is any conflict. In the case of Ukraine, the official wording is that the Germans bear a responsibility for the happenings, the adventures of the last war.
German government officials have said they oppose sending arms to Ukraine as they fear that such deliveries could push tensions higher and make negotiations more difficult. That's why Germany remains one of the world's top arms producers and exporters, with sales increasing 21% from 2016 to 2020. Kiev is furious over Germany's decision and is accusing Berlin of encouraging Russia to invade Ukraine, while the Kremlin denies the allegations. The US, Britain, and several Baltic states have agreed to send Kiev weapons, including anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles. Meanwhile, some 90 tons of US lethal aid arrived in Ukraine on Saturday. The consignment is the first shipment of a $200 million package the US approved in December. Conversely, the shipment arrived hours after Russia's foreign minister and his U.S. counterpart held what they called frank talks to try to reduce the chance of a wider conflict in Ukraine. Also, it is believed that Washington is using the Ukraine crisis as a pretext to further its policy of attempting to restrain Russia and China. Washington has threatened several German companies involved in the construction of the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline with economic sanctions. The completed multi-billion dollar pipeline is set to double Russian gas supplies to Germany, but has been entangled in a highly politicized approval process.
That pipeline, since more than 1 month, is ready to deliver. It's ready to deliver all that is missing, or nearly all that is missing in the European and German market. But we are stopping it. We are blocking it on behalf of Washington. Crazy story.
Therefore, this is every indication that it is NATO members who are escalating tensions around Ukraine. The US, its NATO allies, and Ukraine have accused Moscow of amassing troops near Ukraine's border for a possible invasion. But Moscow says it has deployed troops along its western border to ensure its security in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. The UK has accused Russia of trying to install an ally in Ukraine. This provoked a strong response from Moscow, calling the allegations nothing but nonsense and disinformation. In a statement released on Saturday, the British Foreign Office claimed to have information that indicates the Russian government is looking to install a pro-Russian leader in Kiev and is considering a former Ukrainian lawmaker as a potential candidate. It also claimed that Russia is gearing up to invade and occupy Ukraine.
They are doing regime change globally, and they think this is their God-given right to do that. They want it for Iran, they want it for South American countries like Venezuela, they tried with Guaido. This is typical Western policy, and now they're accusing again, you know, another country of what they are doing themselves. That is also a very typical US and NATO story.
It seems that London is following in Washington's footsteps. It has also threatened Russia with severe economic sanctions if it goes ahead with the alleged scheme. The UK had also supplied 2,000 missiles and a team of elite troops to Ukraine this week amid rising tensions. The timing and mysterious nature of the intelligence disclosure coincides with bombshell revelations about a series of parties at Downing Street during COVID lockdowns, as well as a record inflation level. It is also fueling the widespread discontent with the Boris Johnson government. He is now facing resignation calls even from within his own party. This raises a question, and that is whether some in the British government are simply eager to deflect attention from the problems that threaten to topple Prime Minister Boris Johnson.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, coordination of factors and elements of training for raising children. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of coordination of factors and elements of raising children or raising kids. As we know that the environment, especially in the vest that we have within the house, and if you're following the Islamic lifestyle, we try to train kids or raise our children in a way so that they become the best Muslims in the Western society, in the non-Islamic society. But there is a factor, and that factor is that when they go out, even if you're going for the shopping, if you're going to the park, if you're going to any place outside your house, they see a non-Islamic environment around them. They are attentive towards a non-Islamic environment. And this atmosphere basically can bring a duality in their personality. So we need to somehow control this being the parents. And it can be controlled if we can control our movements, if we can control our basically the places where we visit, and if we can control and we can limit these things somehow in the Western society where people are living in non-Muslim countries, they can handle this coordination which is between the factor of inside house environment and the outside house environment, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of coordination of factors and elements of raising children. And obviously, we said there are many factors. Now, there is another factor that generally people think, like, if we have less kids, less children, we can train them better. Whereas in the Islamic teachings, in the narrations, it is emphasized to have more kids, more children. One of the reason is that having more children makes training children easier, makes raising children according to the Islamic lifestyle or Islamic teaching easier. Why? Because in raising kids, in raising children, in training the children, the factor which has more impact on our children is the existence of their elder brother or sister. So if we have put our all potential on the first two kids, for example, or maybe the first child who is either a boy or a girl, and we could train him or her in the best way, the rest of children, they follow their brother and sister. They see what their brother is doing, they see what their sister is doing, and they try to copy. And they want to be someone like them because they are attached to you and they're helping you in the house. And what you do, they are doing the same thing. So the children at the in the house who are small, they try to follow them. They try to follow their footsteps. And it makes your life easy. It makes your life easy because you have put all your potential in the first two children. And the rest of the children are just following their brothers and sisters. Therefore, we need to also emphasize and pay attention to this factor as well, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
With you. What about you? Meaningful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In its propaganda portraying itself as a champion of human rights, the EU has declared that wherever they may be in the world, a child is a child first and foremost. But it appears that when it comes to Palestinian children, only exceptional cases like those of Amal Nakhle merit EU sympathy. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Tamara Nassar, journalist. This article is published under the heading, For EU, a child is a child, except when Palestinian. Stay tuned for more. There are growing calls on the Zionist regime to immediately release a medically vulnerable Palestinian teen who has been imprisoned for more than a year without charge or trial. Amal Nakhle was 17, a child, when the Zionist regime authorities arrested him in January 2021. He lives with a rare chronic autoimmune disease. He recently tested positive for the coronavirus, which heightens the concern about his well-being because his condition places him at increased risk of serious illness. Following the positive coronavirus test, the Zionist regime transferred Nakhle to the Ramal prison clinic, which is nicknamed the slaughterhouse by detained Palestinians. Since his arrest, the Zionist regime military has held Nakhle in administrative detention, which can be renewed indefinitely. Under the most recent renewal earlier this month, Nakhle will be detained until at least 18th of May. Like all other administrative detainees, Nakhle is held based on secret evidence that the Zionist regime military authorities refused to show to him or his lawyers. Several UN agencies are urging Nakhle's immediate and unconditional release. Amal's case is one of the more prolonged cases where a Palestinian child has been detained without charge or trial, said the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights in a joint appeal with Children's Agency UNICEF and Palestine Refugee Agency UNRWA. It is, however, not an isolated case. Currently, at least another three Palestinians are in administrative detention who were under the age of 18 when first detained, the UN agencies added. In December, the UN Human Rights Council's Working Group on Arbitrary Detention issued an opinion on Nakhle's case, concluding that the Zionist regime should release him immediately. Uncharacteristically, the European Union also called on the Zionist regime to release Nakhle, as did the Irish diplomatic mission in the occupied West Bank. The EU mission in the West Bank said recently that Nakhle must be released immediately. EU representatives rarely intervene on behalf of Palestinian prisoners held by the Zionist regime. When they do comment, it is usually in the advanced stages of a hunger strike. Even then, the EU does not demand their release. At most, the EU calls for the detainee to be charged and receive a fair trial. But there is no such thing as a fair trial for Palestinians subjected to the Zionist regime military occupation. Palestinians from the West Bank are subject to the Zionist regime's military tribunals, which have a near 100% conviction rate. A feature of the Zionist regime system of apartheid is that Jewish settlers living in the West Bank are not subject to the military tribunals, but to the Zionist regime civilian courts. Previously, the EU urged that the Zionist regime halt the extensive use of administrative detention, implying the practice may be used, if more sparingly. But most commonly, the EU expresses varying levels of concern. In short, in the rare cases when the EU is not silent about the thousands of Palestinian political prisoners, including children, held by the Zionist regime, its statesmen are muted and late. Of course, Amal Nachle must be released immediately and unconditionally, as should all Palestinian children and political detainees held by the Zionist regime. The Zionist regime is holding 160 other Palestinian children, and 500 Palestinians are currently imprisoned without charge or trial. The Zionist regime is the only regime in the world that routinely subjects children, and only Palestinian children, to military tribunals. But it is notable that the EU is only willing to demand the immediate and unconditional release of Nachle. Could it be that EU officials are willing to do so only because he can be portrayed as sufficiently deserving of their sympathy due to his medical condition? In his propaganda portraying itself as a champion of human rights, the EU has declared that, wherever they may be in the world, a child is a child first and foremost. Every child's rights must be, therefore, fully and equally protected. But it appears that, when it comes to Palestinian children, only exceptional cases like those of Amal Nachle merit EU sympathy. Nachle and the hundreds of other Palestinians arbitrarily imprisoned by the occupier are currently boycotting the Zionist regime's military courts. The protest was launched on the first day of the year as an act of collective resistance to a system Israeli human rights group B'Tselem describes as a Kafka's legal reality.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha
Question: what changes do you feel are needed regarding the position of women in Iranian society? Imam Khomeini replied, "We shall never allow women to be merely men's sex object. Islam has prohibited abortion. Women can gain the right to execute a divorce if she adds this condition to her marriage contract. The respect Islam shows women and the freedom it grants her is equaled by no other system or laws or school of thought." December 28, 1978.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the search of Islam. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has mentioned that we want to institute Islamic justice in this country. Now,
this part of speech, we can say, like, it's a broad thing that Imam has said. Obviously, it's a small part of that, but there is a background behind it. And the background is that we can ask ourselves that, is the justice or the system of justice that we have in today's world, is it not answerable to the demands of people which they had from the judiciary or from the way of justice? Or the system of justice which we are following, is it unjust? And is that the reason what Imam has said that we want to institute Islamic justice in this country? Is there anything wrong with the system, existing systems? The answer is yes, there is something wrong. And there is a problem with the judicial system that we have. We do not have justice in today's world. What we have is a man-made justice. Obviously, the judicial system that we have in the world, it is all been made by man. It's a man-made. And those who made these rules, those who had made these laws, they have made it according to their own perception. Obviously, when we look at Allah, we can see, like, people had their own perceptions. If we look at the capital system, in the capital system, obviously, the investor has the main role, and he can earn anything through any source, through any means, and there is no limitation on him. And in that system, when we look at the judicial system, obviously it is in favor of its own system, which is capital. In the social system, we can see, like, it is in the favor of the government, basically, and people do not have the rights. So when we look at the judicial system, we can make many, many examples. And all these examples, which we will bring, they all will have some faults. Why? Because these are man-made, whereas the human being is not created by man. He has been created by God. And when Allah or God has created us, therefore, we need to have a system which has been sent by Him. And it is only the Islamic justice or the Islamic system, which is being made by Allah, the creator of man, and that is the perfect system which we need to follow. Therefore, Imam said, we want to institute Islamic justice in this country.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.